gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
When a bank upgrades its vault, you know, pouring thicker concrete, installing time locks, adding those seismic sensors. Well, something really interesting happens to the behavior of bank robbers.
Right. They don't just give up.
Exactly. They stop trying to blow the vault door entirely. Instead, they just wait in the parking lot for the branch manager to walk to their car. The criminals adapt.
Yeah, the security industry actually calls that the path of least resistance.
Right.
When you spend all your engineering resources hardening, like the mathematical cryptography of a system, you inadvertently push adversaries to attack the weakest remaining links.
Which is usually us.
Yes. In the context of Bitcoin, those links are the interfaces we read, the servers we connect to, and ultimately our physical bodies.
And that dynamic is exactly the lens we are looking through today. Welcome to this week's episode, a deep dive into the latest developments in Bitcoin and self-custody.
Glad to be here.
We are here to cut through the noise and deliver the most vital updates for you. Because our mission is to treat self-custody as the serious craft that it actually is. Staying informed isn't just some weekend hobby for you. It is a core responsibility.
Absolutely. And we have a pretty sobering overarching theme this week, which is the evolution of threats.
Yeah, it's getting intense.
The cryptography securing the Bitcoin network is incredibly sound, but we are seeing attackers target literally everything surrounding it.
So we are tracking this on three distinct fronts today. First, we are looking at how attackers try to trick the human eye. And that's highlighted by some critical hardware and software patches from Bitbox and Foundation devices.
Some really fascinating bugs in there.
Yeah, truly. Second, we are looking at how attackers scout the human. So that means unpacking major node infrastructure upgrades and this fundamental shift toward compact block filters.
Which is a huge privacy win.
Right. But with some trade-offs we need to discuss. And finally, we have to examine the most disturbing trend of all, which is attacking the human directly. We have some alarming data on a massive spike in sophisticated phishing and actual physical coercion.
Let us start at the hardware layer, though, right where the digital meets the physical. Bitbox just released their Exynos update.
That's firmware version 9.26.3, right?
Exactly. And the patches in this release are, well, they're a perfect case study in how invisible vulnerabilities can compromise a device that feels perfectly secure in your hand.
Yeah. So the first vulnerability they patched is a buffer out of bounds, right? And for the listener who isn't, you know, a firmware engineer, let's break down the actual mechanics here. How does a piece of data physically break out of its boundaries on a signing device?
Sure. So every hardware wallet has allocated memory slots, which are called buffers, and they are designed to hold incoming data.
Like a designated parking space for data.
Right. When you plug your Bitbox into a computer via USB, it expects data packets of a specific size. The vulnerability existed because the Bitbox firmware was trusting the length value declared by the computer.
Ah, I see.
It was trusting it without actually verifying if that incoming data would fit into the device's designated buffer.
So basically, the compromised computer tells the hardware wallet, hey, I'm sending over a standard 50-byte request, but it maliciously sends 500 bytes instead.
Exactly. And the device would just start writing those 500 bytes. Once the 50-byte buffer is full, the remaining 450 bytes just spill over.
Wow.
Yeah, they start overwriting whatever data or instructions were sitting in the adjacent memory sectors. In secure hardware architecture, an out-of-bounds write is a massive red flag.
Because you're basically wiping out the neighboring data.
Worse than that, if an attacker can carefully craft that overflow data, they might overwrite critical execution commands. They're essentially hijacking the control flow of the device.
That is terrifying.
It is. But this update enforces strict bounds checking to prevent this entirely. The device will now verify the data actually fits before it writes anything.
Good. But, you know, the second bug they patched in this update is arguably more dangerous, I think, because it doesn't target the device's memory. It targets the human operating it.
The self-transfer text manipulation bug.
Right. And the release notes call it exactly that. It's brilliantly subtle.
It really is. So when you sign a transaction to send Bitcoin back to yourself, say you're just trying to consolidate some UTXOs.
Which people do all the time when fees are low.
Exactly. A malicious app on your compromised computer could exploit a very specific output mode combination.
And what does that actually look like to the user?
Well, it allowed the app to force the BitBox to display a manipulated, confusing string of text on its physical screen. And this happens just moments before it displays the actual receive address you were trying to verify.
So it's kind of like going to a retail store and an attacker hacks the point of sale terminal. When you go to tap your card, the screen briefly flashes a message saying, you know, charity donation or processing error right before showing the $50 charge.
That is exactly it.
The underlying charge is the same, but the attacker is using the screen to socially engineer you into approving something you don't fully understand.
That captures the psychological manipulation perfectly, because the hardware wallet screen, I mean, it is the ultimate incorruptible source of truth in the entire self-custody model.
Right, because we operate under the assumption that your laptop or your phone is already infected with malware.
Always. You are explicitly trusting the screen on that air-gapped device to tell you the mathematical truth. If an attacker can inject arbitrary text onto that screen, they have completely broken the foundational trust model.
Yeah, because once the screen lies, the entire fortress crumbles. If you can't trust the display, you have nothing. And hey, if you are currently evaluating your signing devices in light of these specific screen verification nuances, you really should check out the hardware wallet's comparison feature on thebitcoinhole.com. It breaks down how different devices handle display trust, open source firmware, and these exact types of threat models. It's super helpful.
It is. Auditing your tools is mandatory. And you know that applies to the software interfacing with those devices as well.
Like the Envoy app.
Right. Foundation Devices pushed a massive update this week for Envoy, bringing it to version 2.3.0.
On the surface, this looks like a purely user experience focused release. I mean, they redesigned the send flow, they added a dedicated address explorer.
Which is great. You can finally browse your entire list of receive and change addresses.
Yeah, long overdue. And they added manual account rescans in case your synchronization gets stuck.
Right. But beneath all those interface improvements, they actually patched a critical vulnerability with the Passport Prime's security check verification.
The SCV.
Yes, the SCV. This process is how the app proves to you that the physical hardware device is genuine, that it hasn't been tampered with in transit.
Like an evil maid attack or supply chain interdiction.
Exactly. Previously, if the device threw a specific error response during this check, the Envoy app could actually misinterpret that error as a successful verification.
Wait, seriously, that is a terrifying failure mode.
It really is.
So the app is giving you the green check mark, literally telling you the hardware is completely secure, when in reality, the device just experienced a failure.
Yeah. If that happened during an actual supply chain attack, you might confidently deposit funds into a compromised device, thinking it passed the security audit.
Wow. Good thing they patched that.
They also resolved a severe flaw on their server side regarding the magic backup feature. Security researchers discovered an unauthenticated vulnerability where someone could list, download, and even delete encrypted backup data directly from Foundation servers.
Even delete it?
Yeah. Now, Foundation confirmed this was caught early and not exploited in the wild, thankfully.
But it highlights a critical lesson. The moment you introduce cloud infrastructure into your self-custody stack, I don't care how encrypted it is, you introduce new attack vectors.
Always.
Which brings us perfectly to the next layer of the battlefield. We spend all this time securing our local hardware, right? But the moment you need to check your balance, your wallet has to ask the network for information.
It has to broadcast.
Right. And if you don't run your own node, you are basically asking a stranger server. You might be mathematically secure, your keys are safe, but you are leaking your financial privacy. You are letting adversaries scout the human.
And MyNode drove this point home aggressively this week. Their public messaging simply stated, and I love this interesting of, if you care about privacy, stop outsourcing your Bitcoin questions. Run your own node.
Simple and to the point.
Very. And they followed through by pushing version 0.3.45.
So what was the primary driver for this specific MyNode update?
It was an urgent Tor upgrade. If you are running the older Tor 0.4.8 series, you have to update immediately.
Why immediately?
Because Tor relies on a decentralized network of directory authorities to map the hidden services. When the network consensus parameters update this September, those older relays will be officially deprecated.
So if you don't update, your node will just drop off the privacy network completely.
It will go totally blind.
That's a hard deadline. But we are seeing infrastructure hardening everywhere right now, not just with my node.
Right. Bitcoin Core maintainers took the highly unusual step of releasing versions 29.4, 30.3, and 31.1 simultaneously this week.
Yeah, when you see multiple major versions getting patched on the exact same day, it almost always points to a severe denial of service vulnerability at the peer-to-peer network layer.
Absolutely. They had to backport the fix across every active version to ensure the broader network couldn't be intentionally crashed.
Like by malicious actors just spamming invalid block requests.
Exactly. It's a massive coordinated effort to keep the network robust.
But I think the most fascinating infrastructure shift this week came from the team at Bitcoin Safe. They announced they are making compact block filters the default setting for their wallet.
This is a huge deal.
It really is. They completely removed the strict requirement to run an Electrum server to maintain your privacy.
This is a monumental shift in how we think about the trade-off between infrastructure burden and personal sovereignty.
Yeah, let's break that down. To understand why this matters, we kind of have to look at how an Electrum server actually works.
Sure. When you run a personal Electrum server, like Fulcrum, it meticulously indexes every single transaction for every single address on the entire blockchain.
It's essentially a massive, highly optimized database.
Right. So when your wallet asks for your balance, the server just looks it up and answers instantly.
But running Fulcrum is heavy. I mean, it takes days to sync. It requires a massive solid-state drive, and it demands constant maintenance.
Which is why a lot of people don't run one.
Right. And if a user doesn't want to run their own, they usually just connect their wallet to a public Electrum server.
And the moment they do that, they hand over their master public key to a total stranger.
Yeah, that public server now knows every address you own, your total balance, your transaction history, and your IP address.
It is a catastrophic privacy leak.
Complete disaster. So how do compact block filters solve this without requiring that massive local database?
Compact block filters basically flip the architecture on its head. Instead of your wallet asking a server about your specific addresses, the Bitcoin network nodes create a highly compressed mathematical representation for all the data inside every block.
That's the filter.
Exactly. Your wallet simply downloads these tiny filters and checks them locally, like right on your phone or laptop.
So the wallet is basically asking itself, does the math in this filter match any of my private keys?
Yes. And only if the answer is yes, does the wallet actually reach out of the network and download that one specific full block to extract the transaction.
Okay, I want to push back on this though. Yes, the privacy is incredible because the network only knows you downloaded a block, not which address you were actually looking for. But scanning those filters locally is incredibly resource intensive. I mean, it drains the battery on your mobile device, it eats up data bandwidth, and it is significantly slower than just querying an Electrum index.
It is slower, yes.
So does moving to compact block filters sacrifice too much usability in the name of privacy?
Well, it demands more from the client device, unquestionably. But we have to look at the macro trend here. We want self-custody to be within everyone's reach, not just systems administrators who have server racks in their basements.
Fair point.
Compact block filters offer a way to achieve near-perfect privacy and verification without forcing the user to maintain a heavy, indexed server infrastructure in their living room. It is the ultimate pragmatic tool for preserving sovereignty.
I hear that, but that pragmatic approach creates a new tension, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, we built this incredibly private, slow-moving fortress for our deep cold storage using block filters. But Bitcoin is also a medium of exchange. The moment we move from the base chain to the spending layer, the Lightning Network, we are forced to navigate an entirely different set of trade-offs.
Between sovereign control and everyday reliability.
Exactly.
The Lightning Network operates on completely different mechanics. It requires constant uptime, liquidity management, and really complex pathfinding to route a payment from point A to point B.
Right, and the updates we saw this week are directly trying to abstract that complexity away from the user. Like, Electrum just dropped version 4.8.0.
A very significant update.
Yeah, they are finally shedding some legacy technical debt by completely removing BIP 70 support.
Oh, good riddance.
Seriously, BIP 70 was that old, clunky payment protocol pushed heavily around, what, 2013?
Something like that. It required merchants to have specific SSL certificates just to request payments.
Right. It caused endless compatibility issues and is universally considered obsolete today. So in its place, they've added support for LNURL LUD17.
LUD17 is a massive upgrade for the ecosystem.
Explain why.
Well, rather than relying on HTTP web server requests to initiate a Lightning payment, LUD17 allows wallets to encode Lightning URL data natively into standard URIs.
So no more waiting for a web server to respond.
Exactly. It makes scanning a QR code and fetching an invoice significantly faster and way less prone to network timeouts. But the truly architectural shift in Electrum 4.8.0 is the implementation of lazy trampoline routing.
Right. This is where we really hit the trade-off between sovereignty and convenience. Explain the mechanics of a normal Lightning payment versus a trampoline payment.
Normally, your Lightning node needs to maintain a constantly updated map of the entire network graph. Every node, every channel, every fee rate.
Just huge.
Massive. When you want to buy a coffee, your node calculates the most efficient route through that massive graph. For a mobile phone connecting over cellular data, maintaining that map is a nightmare.
It drains your battery, yeah. And if the map is even slightly out of sync, the payment just fails.
Right, so trampoline routing is essentially delegating the navigation.
Like paying to use the express toll lane in rush hour traffic?
That's a good way to put it. With trampoline routing, your lightweight wallet admits it doesn't know the full route. So it wraps the payment in an onion-routed package and bounces it to a massive, well-connected trampoline node.
And you pay that node a slightly higher routing fee.
Yes, you pay a bit more, and you outsource the heavy computation. The trampoline node figures out the rest of the path to the destination for you.
And we saw a parallel philosophy with the Aqua Wallet update this week, version 0.5.1. They re-engineered their routing so that Lightning payments are now broadcast directly to Bolts.
Bolts being a prominent swap provider in this
case. By firing the payment directly to them, Bolt sees the incoming liquidity instantly, and that prevents short-lived Lightning invoices from expiring while the network tries to blindly find a route.
It solves a massive user experience problem.
It does, but I have to ask the hard question here. When you use a trampoline node, or when you broadcast directly to Bolts, you are relying on centralized service providers to facilitate your transaction.
Yes.
Are we sacrificing the core ethos of permissionless money just so our coffee payments go through faster? Are we just reinventing banks?
That is the defining debate of Lightning development today. Under the hood, yes, you are trusting these specific routing nodes to forward your payment and not to censor you.
Right.
But we have to be precise about what is actually at risk here. Because Lightning uses onion routing, the trampoline node doesn't necessarily know the final destination of the payment. And swap providers like Bolts operate strictly non-custodially.
Meaning they can't steal the funds?
Correct. But they could theoretically drop the payment and refuse to route it.
Which is still censorship.
It is. That is the compromise. These workarounds exist because the reality of mobile hardware simply cannot support full graph pathfinding natively yet. For Lightning to function as a reliable spending tool today, developers are abstracting the logistics.
The user retains custody of the private keys, but they are temporarily outsourcing the logistics of the network.
Exactly.
And this leads us to the most intense part of this week's report. We have spent this entire time talking about how adversaries attack memory buffers, spoof hardware screens, and exploit network graphs.
The technical perimeter.
Right. But as the cryptography becomes harder to crack, the attackers are bypassing the code entirely. The most pressing threat to Bitcoiners right now isn't software. It is human manipulation and physical violence.
The human element is the ultimate backdoor, and the attackers are becoming incredibly sophisticated at exploiting it.
Jameson Lopp published a detailed postmortem on the Casa blog this week regarding a highly advanced social engineering campaign. Attackers are posing as Google support, and the automation they are using is staggering.
It really is wild.
They purchase leaked phone numbers from data breaches, run them through auto dialers using 650 area codes so the call looks like it's coming from Silicon Valley.
Making it look highly legitimate.
Right. And they play an automated message claiming your account is under attack. The moment the victim presses a button out of panic, a real human operator takes over.
But the truly devastating part of this attack is how they bypass standard email security to establish trust. They aren't just sending emails from domains that look like Google.
Yeah.
They are weaponizing Google's actual infrastructure.
The mechanics of this blew my mind. So normally when an email hits your spam filter, it checks two cryptographic proofs, right? SPF, which verifies the sending server is authorized, and DKIM, which proves the email wasn't altered in transit.
Standard anti-spoofing measures.
Right. If an attacker spoofs an email, these checks fail. So instead, the attackers go to a legitimate Google support form. They enter the victim's email address as the target, and they paste their malicious phishing link directly into the form's input field.
Which then populates the subject line of the automated receipt.
Exactly. Google's own servers generate the email. Google servers cryptographically sign it.
Because the email genuinely originates from Google, the SBF and DKIM checks pass perfectly.
It's brilliant in the worst way. Your email provider flags it as a highly trusted, verified message and drops it straight into your priority inbox.
And if the victim clicks that link, the attackers harvest the session tokens, bypass two-factor authentication, immediately delete any real security alerts, and begin draining financial accounts.
It is terrifyingly clever. But as devastating as digital theft is, physical theft is escalating to a level that demands an immediate reality check for anyone holding their own keys.
This is the hardest part to talk about.
It is. Bulbitcoin released a data analysis this week regarding the fallout from the European Union's DSC8 directive.
Right. The DSC8 directive forces cryptocurrency service providers across Europe to report the identities, physical addresses, and transaction balances of their users directly to tax authorities.
From a security engineering perspective, when you mandate the centralized collection of granular personal wealth data, you are intentionally building a massive honeypot.
And every database eventually leaks.
Without exception. The statistics Bulbitcoin shared trace a direct, undeniable line between regulatory data collection and physical violence.
According to their tracking of physical coercion, what we grimly refer to as $5 wrench attacks incidents rose by 75% in 2025.
75%? That's massive.
And in the first quarter of 2026, they spiked another 41%. Europe now accounts for 82% of these violent attacks globally.
But the detail in that report that literally stopped me in my tracks was the victim profile. Over half of the victims this year held absolutely no cryptocurrency themselves.
They were family members, spouses, children, elderly parents.
It's sickening.
The attackers are acquiring these leaked compliance databases, looking at the high net worth balances, and cross-referencing the names with public real estate and tax records.
So they find the home addresses of relatives and use them as physical leverage against the person who actually holds the private keys. We spent all this time debating the privacy trade-offs of compact block filters versus Electrum servers, but attackers are just showing up at the front door of our parents' houses. I mean, does the community need to drastically reevaluate our threat models?
The data dictates that we must. Absolute digital privacy is no longer just a cypherpunk philosophy or an ideological talking point. It is a baseline requirement for physical safety.
Right.
If your name, your physical address, and an estimate of your holdings exist in a centralized, compliant database, you are an eventual target. The physical violence we are seeing is a direct downstream consequence of upstream data leaks.
It's a sobering reality.
This is why tools like non-KYC acquisition, running your own node, and utilizing CoinDoins to mathematically break the heuristic links between your identity and your UTXOs, these are not just for privacy enthusiasts anymore. They are literal defensive tools against physical harm.
Let's bring this all together. This week is a masterclass in why self-custody requires active, perpetual vigilance. The key takeaways are clear. Number one, update your firmware.
Always.
The BitBox and Envoy patches prove that even the most reputable hardware is reliant on software that needs constant auditing to prevent memory leaks and screen spoofing. Number two, run your own node infrastructure.
Whether you endure the heavy lift of a full Electrum server or utilize the lightweight privacy of compact block filters, you must stop asking strangers for your balances.
Exactly. And number three, implement absolute zero trust regarding incoming communications. Do not trust caller ID. Do not trust an email simply because it has a valid cryptographic signature from a tech giant. And systematically minimize your exposure in centralized data honeypots.
Sound advice.
If you found this week's episode useful in sharpening your self-custody skills, please take a moment to rate the show and leave a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It genuinely helps us keep the signal strong in a very noisy space.
I will leave you with a final thought to mull over. We began today by talking about bank vaults and physical perimeters. Today, the most dangerous vulnerability isn't a flaw in your cryptographic wall. It is the map pointing directly to your front door.
Yeah.
So if the databases of compliant financial institutions are now serving as the primary scouting tools for violent criminals, does holding your wealth transparently in legacy systems eventually become more dangerous than being your own bank?
That is a chilling thought to end on. Keep your keys safe, keep your nodes synced, and we'll see you in the hole next week.
Your own keys, stay sovereign. The Bitcoin.
Bitcoin hold.